I have to admit to some nervousness introducing the chief rabbi during the week of Parshat Vayera. Almost 20 years ago, around the time of the launch of Jewish continuity, the chief rabbi asked my dad to speak at the pre-Yamim Noraim Rabbinic Conference of the United Synagogue on the subject of the new organization. The questions from the rabbis turned to the alternative appearance of Continuity's chief executive, Clive Lawton, particularly his sandals and ponytail. My dad unwisely answered with an analogy based on this week's parsha. He said that when Hashem promised that Abraham's descendants would be as numerous as the stars in the heavens, people could only see a small percentage of the stars. Now we have an odd-looking device, the Hubble telescope, and we can identify many more stars. And sometimes we need an odd-looking teacher to reach hidden Jews. The assembled rabbis tore my dad to shreds. Chief Rabbi, you commiserated with him. And my dad, not missing a beat, replied, "It was a character-building experience." Chief Rabbi, this is a much more forgiving crowd. But I have to say that your leadership, without a ponytail or sandals, has indeed illuminated many, many more hidden Jews. And for that, the whole Jewish world owes you a great debt. Rabbis, ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to welcome Chief Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks.
Kvoda Rav, beloved friends, it's an enormous privilege to join you in this wonderful community, this lovely shul and the lovely school, whose approach to Torah is so close to the hearts of Elaine and myself. Equally wonderful to be here together, as you've heard, with Deborah and Sidney Braun to wish the Mazel Tov for the Bar Mitzvah. Sorry we missed it. We were running at some speed at the time. I can't remember where we were, but at least it's lovely to join you this morning. And as Deborah has explained, for us, knowing Deborah's parents, Michael and Penny Sinclair, has been an extraordinary privilege. Michael did things that had never been done in Anglo-Jewry, and as a certain leading figure, not Jewish, once said, no good deed goes unpunished. So Michael did it, and all of us who were involved in this did create certain waves of controversy, the end result of which we can see today. An Anglo-Jewry that's gone through a renaissance in every sphere. Every sphere touched on by that organization that Deborah's father, Michael, chaired. And we have moved, for instance, in those 18 years, from a community where about 25 or at most 30% of Jewish children went to Jewish day schools to the situation now where that figure is almost 70%. So, and every other cultural and educational activity has gone through a renaissance. And for that, sometimes you have to shake people up a bit. And if there's one thing people don't like, it's being shaken up. So we caused a lot of controversy, and Baruch Hashem, it was a machloket l'shem shemayim. And at that particular occasion, where a layperson, Deborah's father, had invested huge amounts of money, but much more importantly, unbelievable amounts of time, to see him criticized by my own rabbinical colleagues for thinking outside the box. And then for him to turn to me afterwards and say that was a character-forming experience actually helped me in all subsequent years, because I am always facing controversy, and I hope my character is constantly being formed. It is a lovely delight to be with Kvoda Rav, Rabbi Weber, Rabbi of the Clanton Park Synagogue, because my own Rav, Reb Nachum Rabinovich, whom I succeeded as head of Jews College in London and who is now, has been for many years, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Hesder Yeshiva in Maale Adumim, came to Britain from being Rabbi of Clanton Park. And that was the greatest gift I ever had, to have the privilege of studying with one of your predecessors for 12 years. Friends, let me just share with you one very simple idea. We want to open it up for questions and answers. But, you know, in Parashat Vayera, we have this extraordinary, unprecedented dialogue between Avram and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Avram says, Chalila lecha la'asot kadava azeh la'amit rasha'im tzadikim rasha liyot tzadik karasha chalila lach ha'shofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat. Extraordinary, extraordinary challenge. And if you look in the previous verses, you will see that Hashem himself invited that challenge. Hamachase ani me Avraham. Hashem tells or lets Avram hear his plans just in order to invite him to challenge him. And there then follows an extraordinary bargaining match. Ula yesh chamishim tzadikim b'toch ha'ir. Maybe there are 50 righteous in the city, maybe 45, maybe 40, until it comes down to 10. And the question that I ask, we all ask, is why those figures? Are they just plucked from the void? Are they random? Or is there some significance to them? Rashi explains on Ula yesh chamishim tzadikim b'toch ha'ir that actually there were five cities of the plains, Sodom, Amorah, and the other three that we read about in yesterday's parasha. And therefore what Avram was saying is, maybe there is a minion of tzaddikim in each of the cities. In other words, when there is a minion, there is a tzibur. Where there are 10 Jews practicing Judaism, I'm sorry, 10 in the case of Sodom, 10 righteous people being righteous together, that is no longer individuals, it begins to be a community. Righteousness moves from the private to the public. And in virtue of a minion, a whole city may be saved. Why, having had God concede that, does Avram then move to 45? Well, if you work it out, he's saying, if 10 is good enough, 9 should be good enough. And why, what is the logic there? The Gemara in Brachas talks about the minimum requirement for a minion, and it says 10, and you know, eda, eda. And then it says, will 9 do? Having just said, you need 10, why does the Gemara say, will 9 do? It says, tisha v'aron mitztarafim. If you have 9 people, the ark joins with the 9 to make 10. What does that mean? The Shechina, Hashem himself, you're short of a minion, I'll help make up the minion. HaKadosh Baruch Hu joins the minion to turn 9 into 10. And so Avram, God concedes that as well. So Avram says, listen, if you'll join with 9 to make 10, won't you join with 8 to make 9? Are you with me? Once he's conceded, will you go on? And that leads to the final request. Maybe there are 10 tzaddikim in the area. Now, 10 tzaddikim means, if we're dealing with 5 cities, 2 tzaddikim in each city. Why did Avram stop at 10? Why didn't he go on to 5? I mean, that's the logical stopping point. And the answer is, Avram knew that if there's only one tzaddik in the city, that tzaddik cannot save the city. And where did he know this from? From Noach. Hashem says to Noach, Oscho ra'isi tzaddik b'dor hazeh, I've seen you, and only you, righteous in this generation. And we know Noach saved himself, but he didn't save the city. So Avram knew that if there's only one tzaddik, that doesn't save the city. That's why he stopped at 2. Now why should that be so? What's the logic behind it? And the answer, I think, is this. If there's only one tzaddik in the city, that tzaddik isn't a tzaddik enough. He didn't make anyone else a tzaddik. He kept his righteousness to himself. So how much of a tzaddik can there be? He can save himself. But he's only interested in saving himself. Therefore, he cannot save the city. That's a very compelling logic. We were having lunch on Shabbos down there. Everything's in Bathurst Street, right? So we were a little... The other end, I don't know, where's Thornhill? Is that... up. Oh, I see. You know, we made Aliyah. We went to Poland with the professor of games theory. So, you know, it reminded me of certain elementary facts about game theory. And game theory tells us there are certain things called zero-sum games, which means that the total is fixed. So if I have more, you have less. So let's use a little games theory here to look at the two great goods in life for which people compete. People compete for two things, for wealth and for power. The competition for wealth generates economics. The competition for power generates politics. Now, do the following simple sum. It will not test your advanced algebraic facilities. Supposing I have $1,000 and I decide to share that with 9 other people, how much do I have left? I have 1/10 of what I began with. Supposing I have, let's suppose I'm the chairman of the shul, and I have total power, and in some moment of lunacy, I decide to share that with 9 other people. How much power do I have? 1/10 of what I began with. Wealth and power at any given moment, not over time, but at any given moment, are zero-sum games, so that the more I have, the less you have, the more I share, the less I have. Now consider the following. Consider love. If I share love with 9 other people, do I have less? If I share friendship with 9 other people, do I have less? If I share influence with 9 other people, do I have less? First, there was only me. Now, there are 10 of us. I have more. Supposing I share knowledge with 9 other people, do I have less? On the contrary, mikol melamdai hiskalti, the best way of learning anything is to teach it. So we have certain goods which the more we give away, the more we have. They are non-zero sum goods. And I call those spiritual goods. Wealth and power are material goods. But all these other things, love, friendship, knowledge, trust, are spiritual goods. And the remarkable thing about spiritual goods is the more you give away, the more you have. And now you understand the logic of why Noah was not able to save his generation. I find a lot of Jews come to me and say, you know, if I reach out to less from people, won't that compromise my Yiddishkeit? Isn't the best way of staying from and making sure my family stays from? It's just to have nothing to do with people who are less religious than I am. And when they make that statement, they are engaging in a fundamental fallacy. They are thinking of spirituality as a material good. It's like wealth. It's like power. The more I share, the less I have. Actually, spiritual goods are the exact opposite. The more I share, the more I have. And that is why Avram knew that if there's only one tzaddik in the city, he hasn't shared his righteousness with others. And therefore, there's a limit to his tzidkus, to his righteousness. But if you share your righteousness the way Avram did, that makes you more righteous, not less. Lifting others, you yourself are lifted. That was the wonderful thing about the Aron, you remember? Aron no se et no sav. They thought they were lifting the ark. Actually, the ark was lifting them. And that is what happens whenever we reach out to the those who are less engaged, less committed than we are. We ourselves have not less, but more. My father, Oliver Sholem, was a very simple man because he came over as a 6-year-old child with very poor parents, and they never made really a living. He had to leave school at the age of 14, never had an education, and never made a success in business. He sold schmatters in the equivalent of what you would call in New York, the Lower East Side. I don't know what Toronto equivalent is. I can't imagine Toronto ever having such an equivalent. It's altogether above such things. But, you know, we're so, you know, some people tended to ask me, you know, how come I became a Rav and so on and so forth. My dad, Oliver Shalom, didn't know very much. And he was painfully shy. But he was one of those Ashrei Yoshevei Ve'Sechai. He was always happy inside a shul. And so, as a child, I remember that in our little suburb where there weren't many shulgoers, my dad, despite his painful shyness, walk every evening he'd walk around the streets looking for mezuzahs. And wherever he saw a mezuzah, he would knock on the door. This I can only imagine how much this caused him, because he really was shy. And he would say, "I see you have a mezuzah on the door. Maybe you're Jewish?" And if they said yes, he said, "Oh, lovely." He said, "Look, I'm going to shul on Shabbos. Would you like to come with me?" And he was, in his quiet way, without ever knowing it, because the word hadn't been coined then, he was a kiruv worker. And just, you know, in the most simple way, "Come to shul, you know, let's walk together." And I think this made a huge impression on myself and my three brothers, seeing Dad Oliver Shalom wanting to share his Yiddishkeit with others. He didn't have much, but what he had, he would share with others. And actually, Deborah, I think you'll agree that your dad and all Kol Misha Oskim B'Tzorchei Tzivu Be'emuna, anyone who gives of their time to work for the Jewish community, to work for the sake of others, somehow gives their children a gift that is greater than any material goods you could give them. I think the greatest gift parents can ever give children is to allow their children to see them making some sacrifice for the sake of others. I don't know of any greater gift. I mean, we were just with some people who were on kinder transport. You had your own in 1947, didn't you, when 1,000 children were taken from Germany and brought to Canada, because we were at the home of one of them last night. In Britain, we had kinder transport in 1939, which saved 10,000 children from the Holocaust. And we had a gathering some years ago of the kinder transport, who are now scattered around the world, and they came together in London. And they were speaking to them, a film producer called Richard Attenborough. Have you come across Richard Attenborough? Richard Attenborough isn't Jewish, so, you know, what was he doing at a gathering of kinder transport? The answer is very simple. He told this story. He said, my father was the headmaster of a school in the English countryside. And he said one day in 1939, he and my mother called the three of us. Richard has a famous brother called David Attenborough, famous naturalist, and there were three brothers. He said, "My parents called us into the study and they said, 'Children, we want to adopt two Jewish girls from Germany, Helga and Edith, who have lost their family, and we want to adopt them and bring them into our home. But that will mean sacrifices. You know, what was shared until now between five will have to be shared now between seven, which means you'll have less. And we will have to share everything, even our love. Because," and they said to their three children, "you have us, but they have no one." And when Richard Attenborough, and they did indeed adopt these two Jewish girls, saving their lives. And Richard Attenborough was telling that story with tears in his eyes. And he said, "That was the most important day of my life." You see, his parents had given him and his brothers the opportunity themselves to make a sacrifice for the sake of others. And that turned this man into the man who produced Gandhi and all these great, great moral films. Why? Because he'd had that opportunity to share something with someone else. So I hope we see that in Avram's dialogue with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there's something deeply significant about how he begins, how he ends. And that to be righteous for yourself alone is not enough to save the city. And the more we share our Judaism with others, the more Judaism we will have. Thank you very much indeed. We have some time for questions. On anything, sorry. Yeah. One God is not enough. Are you suggesting we have two? No, I know exactly what you're suggesting. And you are right. And that is the single most radical theological proposition at the heart of Judaism. No other religion understands God that way. God needs us. As his shutafim b'ma'aseh bereshit, as his partners in the work of creation. Now, go figure. What is it that God cannot do alone and needs our help for? There is only one thing that God cannot do on his own, which is make his presence live in the hearts of human beings. For that he needs our help. Precisely because he gave us free will, it means we have to choose to let God into our lives. So he called on Avram to lead the way in living a life that would make others aware that letting God into your life is a transformative experience. And it is remarkable that a man, Avram, who ruled no empires, commanded no great army, performed no miracles, and uttered no great prophecies, became the most influential human being who ever lived. It is extraordinary if you think about it. Today, 2.2 billion Christians, 1.4 billion Muslims, and a few of us, most of whom it seems to me live in Toronto, more than half of the 7 billion people on the face of Earth today acknowledge Avram Avinu as their spiritual ancestor. It is an extraordinary thing because Avram was HaKadosh Baruch Hu's partner, his first partner. And by being HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shutaf, HaKadosh Baruch Hu lives in the world today. Is that roughly what you meant? Or did you mean something else entirely? Yeah, okay. Let's give somebody else a chance. Any other questions? No, on anything. We don't have to be.
There was some superpowers of the world that didn't stand up against the Palestinians wanting to be accepted into this cultural group. In your opinion, why did some of the world superpowers not stand up against them? Why did they abstain from making a decision?
Sorry, yeah, I have to explain. Sorry, we've been traveling. Are you referring to something in the news right now?
UNESCO.
Oh, sorry, what happened? Sorry, I believe you me, we haven't actually had...
The Palestinians were voted full membership status in UNESCO last week.
Well, there are certain things that surpass human understanding, the United Nations being one of them. Nothing to say. It is, I think, Prime Minister Netanyahu said everything that needed to be said in his last speech to the United Nations when he quoted the Lubavitch Rama. Yeah. Yeah.
You mentioned about the percentage of families sending their kids to Jewish school, how it grew from 20% to 80%?
No, 25 or so to 70, yeah.
So it's my understanding here in Toronto, we're going the
very simple. We persuaded the government to pay for it. The government pays for 80% of the building of Jewish day schools and 100% of the tuition other than Limude Kodesh. And we persuaded John Major to do this back in the early 90s, and John Major did it, and then Tony Blair, and then Gordon Brown, and now David Cameron. And the government is incredibly proud of Jewish day schools. It is quite extraordinary. They regard that as one of their greatest successes. Why? Firstly, our Jewish day schools have extraordinarily high achievements in their secular studies and the secular examinations. We have league tables of schools, and the Jewish schools are always there, very, very near the top. The second thing is that the government knows that we train our kids who go through our educational system to be very, very committed and active citizens. They go out doing chesed. They are very responsible young people who take responsibilities to others within and beyond the Jewish community very seriously. So, now, can you do it here? As you know, you tried, and thus far it didn't work, but I think you should have a look at the British model and see whether that might, you know, possibly, if you begin the argument now, it might possibly bring you there at some stage in the future. It's a long, long process before a government will buy into that, and you have to first educate the government. Yeah.
Are you concerned about the current debt crisis in Europe and the impact it's going to have on the Jewish community?
Yeah, I think Europe is like when you're in a plane and the pilot says, fasten your seatbelts, there's turbulence ahead. I think for all sorts of reasons, Europe is going to go through some very difficult times, of which the economic and the debt crisis is only one aspect. You will have seen, I'm sure, on television, in August we had riots in London and Manchester of the most extraordinary kind, because these were not race riots, they weren't religiously motivated, ethnically motivated, they were not even politically motivated. There were a bunch of kids breaking shop windows and looting. And, you know, as I've mentioned before, in Toronto, it is, why did this happen? This is not a simple explanation, but it's part of the explanation. Britain lost the plot when it came to marriage and the family around 40 or 50 years ago. So the Britain today has the highest percentage of teenage pregnancies, the highest percentage of single-parent families, and the highest percentage of children born outside marriage in the world. In 2009, 46% of children in Britain were born outside marriage. Now, 46% throughout the nation. And of course, when you say something about it, and of course I'm constantly speaking about this in the national media, not on behalf of Jews, on behalf of Britain, people say, ah, marriage is just a piece of paper. Now that is, as they say, denial isn't just a river in Egypt, as they say now, part of the world. We know the average length of cohabitation without marriage is less than 2 years. So you have 46% of children in Britain who are likely to grow up without any kind of stable relationship with their biological father. They may grow up with a single mother, or they may grow up with a series of stepfathers. And I'm afraid the incidence of abuse between stepfathers and stepchildren is 80 times as much as it is between biological fathers and their children. A fact that, again, no one dares mention in public. So you have a lot of kids growing up completely unsocialized. because by the time they're 11, they're already stronger than their mothers. They don't have fathers in the community, let alone in their own house. And they're growing up wild. So there's not only an economic problem in Europe, there is a social and moral problem in Europe. And then we have a problem of identity. Europe bought into a concept which, you know, at least they do in Montreal, called multiculturalism, which has had a disastrous effect in Europe. It's a different type of thing than in Quebec. Because we have, you know, I go into a non-Jewish school in a city area anywhere in Britain. I'm dealing with kids from 40 to 50 different ethnic groups, speaking 40 to 50 different native languages. And multiculturalism simply encourages these groups to segregate instead of integrate. So you have huge problems of social cohesion in Europe, which lead to, which were the factor behind the French riots. You will have seen all those car burnings in the summers of 2006, 2007, and at various points. So Europe is in a mess. And one of the reasons why Europe is in a mess is Europe has lost its faith. It's lost its religious life. Europe is the most secular bit of the planet right now. And it was the sort of Christian culture of Europe that kept families together, that sanctified marriage, that taught kids to have responsibility. And so I don't know, you know, we as we were leaving London, it seems like several centuries ago. How long ago was it? Just over a week? I can't remember. And we happened to be in the next room with John Major himself, and John Major's an old friend of Elaine and myself, you know, and he talked very, very gloomily about the economic prospects of saving the euro, and if you don't save the euro, you're not going to save the European Union. So we've been wondering whether there's going to be a Europe for us to fly back to. So, you know, Europe's going to go through difficult times, and it is impossible to predict where it's going to go.
Discuss issues of Israel and Judaism. By extension, when people get out of university into the real world, things have also gotten very difficult for Israel internationally. You have the benefit of being immersed in the world of politics at a higher level in the House of Lords. Can you comment on what we should be doing, how we can respond at our level, and how you see responses at the higher levels that you, the circles within you, within which you travel.
How do we deal with the place of Israel in public perception in the world today? This is a very complex problem, and that is to say there's no one size fits all. No cookie cutter, do you call that? So it has to be done at many different levels. Okay, so let me give you a few for instances. Number one, we knew the campuses were going to be a battleground. And there is no substitute for actually telling campuses that this is unacceptable. So we had a university, I know you had a bad time a few years ago with York University. We had a bad time a few years ago with Manchester University. And I went up and in the presence of the head of the university and the mayor of Manchester and the MPs for Manchester, and I said, this is absolutely unacceptable. Other members of our community did likewise. And today, Manchester is the leader in Britain in being vigilant against radical elements that criticize Israel. So Manchester, from going from the worst of the universities, has gone to the best of the universities. And we now cite that. It has a code of practice, which we want all universities to. So that's you fight the battle campus by campus. But you also want to have certain people on your side. So we have in Britain something called the National Union of Students. I'm not talking about the Union of Jewish Students. I'm talking about the National Union of Students. Every year for over 10 years, Elaine and I, because we've seen this battle shaping up on the campuses. Every year in June, we do a reception in our home for all the leaders of the National Union of Students. I sit with the actual officers of the National Union of Students, almost all of whom are non-Jewish, and I give them a shiur. We learn together for an hour. And then all the others come along and we have a reception in the garden. Sometimes, by a miracle, the sun shines in London in June. You can never rely on it. So every year of National Union of Students has developed, its leaders have had a personal relationship with the chief rabbi, which they have with no other religious leader. No other body does this for us. So whenever we have been in difficult times, the National Union of Students have always stood up for the Jewish students, and that means standing up for Israel. So the problem has never been at the student level. You take other issues like the churches. I don't know if you're aware of this, but either now or in the near future, the churches are going to become the battleground. So because Christians, Palestinian Christians, have been putting huge pressure on all the churches to come out and condemn Israel on the basis of a document that they've put out called the Kairos document. Now, in the summer of this year, in August of this year, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Archbishop of Westminster, who's the head of the Catholics, held a Christian conference on the plight of Christians in the Holy Land. That was the thing. And this could have been an absolute disaster if the churches had come out against Israel, the mainstream churches. Heaven alone knows what would have happened to interfaith relations in Britain. Well, we have spent years, Elaine and myself, getting to know as close personal friends the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Archbishop of Westminster. They are not just friends, they're close personal friends. Now, neither of them is a supporter of Israel. But when push came to shove, when it came to the moment, I sat with them and for the sake of our friendship, they took a stand. So throughout that two-day conference, I didn't attend for all sorts of reasons. But there were plenty of people, plenty of Jews who were attending. Throughout that conference, the two of them absolutely refused to let condemnation of Israel take center stage. And every time somebody wanted to do it, they deflected it. Because as you know, the real plight of Christians in the Middle East, they're better off in Israel than any other country by many miles. So here were two people who stood up for us when it was needed, and that's why you never heard. Even our community never knew that conference took place. Because had it done what the organizers wanted to achieve, it would have been blazoned over every newspaper in the world. I mean, minor churches have come divested from Israel, but for the Church of England, actually the Church of England did take a divestment vote a few years ago, and I spoke to the Archbishop of Canterbury, and then they removed the divestment vote. So, yes, there's a lot to be done in the public media, but I'm trying to show you that there's an enormous amount to be done behind the scenes, building up friends, thinking 10 years in advance even, because, you know, these people are, even the students are 20 years from now going to be leading Britain. So we already have them as friends from the beginning. And that's how we do it. And it's very effective, but it's very, very time consuming. And I hope with our new ambassador, Daniel Tobe, who's just come to Britain, we agreed as soon as we get back from this trip, we're going to sit down because he is very media savvy. He actually wrote the script for a soap opera on Israeli television, a very unusual, it was called Her Chatzer, I never saw it, but it was a soap opera about life in a Hasidic community, and it was the first attempt to show secular Israelis that Hasidim are not demons. And so we've agreed to sit down and look at new ways of doing Hasbara. I think we have time just for one last question. Yeah.
I've had the enormous privilege one thing I noted is that there's one word that I actually haven't heard you utter, which is the word Islam or Muslim. And I think when we speak about, you know, the disintegration of Europe and problems of the Middle East, that's obviously the elephant in the room. Is there something akin to your approach to the Christian world that can be done with respect to the Muslim world to sort of tame it or pacify it or make radical Islam less of a threat than it seems to be?
Of course. Absolutely. Sorry, I wrote a book which appeared on the first anniversary of 9/11 called Dignity of Difference. It caused a certain amount of controversy in the Jewish community, but what you don't know is that the Pakistani High Commissioner, Akbar Ahmed, wrote a full-page article in the Pakistan Times saying, here's a chief rabbi who wants to befriend us. Now, that was a courageous thing for him to do. And I will tell you, he's since moved on from being Pakistani High Commissioner in London. He's now the Ibn Khaldun Professor of Islamic Civilization in Washington. And when we visited him, he asked us to visit him the time before we were in Washington. He did something very extraordinary for a very religious Muslim. And he's a very prominent Muslim. He did the film on Jinnah, you know, the first president of Pakistan. And He gathered a few interfaith leaders, you know, for me to meet in Washington. But before that, he took Elaine and myself into the back room to meet his children. And he asked me, one by one, to give his children a bracha. Now, to make a friend of somebody like that, he calls me Mahatma. I don't know what that means. I think that means Rebbe or something or other, you know. So we do that all along the line, of course. We're constantly reaching out to moderate Muslims. And when I was speaking a couple of years ago to a high-flying group of Muslims in the city, young Muslims, very attached to Britain and to liberal democracy and want to develop a whole different approach to Islam, at the end somebody stood up and said, Chief Rabbi, could you please stop being Chief Rabbi and become Chief Imam? To which I replied, I've got Saras enough already, thank you. So, you know, al titya'ish, you know, it's tremendously important not to despair. You win friends. The Jewish people has enemies. No one is going to deny that. But it also has good friends. And it would make more if we tried to make more. So let's make those friends. And they will stand with us in the hour of need. Friends, it's been a pleasure being with you. I agreed to sign some books if anyone would like them. We're off to the airport now, so we'll sit out and sign books. But wonderful to have been with you. May Hashem bless all you do. May He make the community grow and make all your children, children of whom you, the Jewish people, and Hashem will be proud. Thank you.
I just want to, on behalf of everybody here, and really thank the Chief Rabbi and his wife for an extraordinary week almost. And the impact you have had on our community, I think, is unbelievable. The many thousands of people have heard you in the few days and been inspired. And it's been an honor for us to have you and for our community. And we want to wish you well and a well-deserved rest when you get back home to England. And we hope we don't have to wait another 12 years till you come back to Toronto. Thank you very much, and our pleasure.